How does your lawn look? If the answer is not so good, now is the time to do something about it. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Iowa State University Extension turf grass specialist Ryan Adams will be here to talk about lawn care, seeding, reseeding, core aeration, and other late summer tasks. ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will also be here, and he and Ryan will answer your questions about your lawn, garden, and landscape. Send your questions to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and if you've been struggling with a patchy lawn all summer, now is your moment. With me today is Iowa State University Extension turf grass specialist Ryan Adams. We'll talk about lawn care today. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron is here today as well. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And, you know, Richard, I think this summer we have had the question of, can I seed my lawn now more often than ever before? Because it seems like all summer long you've been telling people, no, wait until August.
Well, actually this year the weather has been so mild and fairly rainy that you could have done it almost any time this growing season. Typically, that's not the case, but we've just had very mild temperatures, quite a bit of moisture, and so it's been much more doable this year.
Of course, there was no way to know that back
in Iowa.
In June. All right, so Ryan, what makes this such a good time of year to seed or reseed your lawn?
It was some of the things Richard just mentioned, just that the weather's a lot cooler. You get a lot more rainfall usually in the fall. The soil temperatures are one of the biggest ones. Because if you plant Kentucky bluegrass early in the spring, those soil temperatures are still really cold. And so you don't really get all that good of germination. You don't have to compete with as many weeds in the fall. Just all those things play a huge factor. And that's why primarily for Kentucky bluegrass, we only recommend between about right now and September 15th to seed.
All right. And what kind of problems are we seeing in people's lawns this year? Is there anything specific?
One of the big ones that we're seeing just because of these cooler temperatures is rust, primarily on perennial rye, but have seen quite a bit actually on Kentucky bluegrass as well. And so most people, if they're asking questions, they see their shoes are brown and kind of orange in color. Usually rust is the culprit. And we don't actually recommend to actually spray for the rust and apply a fungicide. Just kind of wait, let the weather, let it take its course. And once the conditions change a little bit, it will kind of just fade away.
All right. And let's say you've been waiting all summer because you listened to Richard and you follow directions very well. And it's time now to seed your lawn. What kind of steps do you take?
The first thing I would look at is just kind of go do a general assessment of the lawn. Figure out what areas that you really want to work on. You know, you might, depending on the situation, you might want to do a full renovation or you might just want to kind of interseed. And so the renovation, if you have a big area that's a lot of weeds, you know, not much grass, those areas are going to be kind of a full renovation. So maybe spraying that whole area with Roundup and kind of starting over, or can you just kind of do just the minimal and just maybe aerify and then come in and seed in some of these areas that you just want to strengthen up and maybe it's a little patchy.
All right. And what are the signs that you actually need to start from scratch? I'm sure my lawn is one, but we're not going to do that. But what else do you need to look at other than it looks like Charity's lawn?
Just large areas that aren't your intended turf grass. So if there's orchard grass, crack grass, some of these harder to kill weeds, if they've completely taken over an area, or ground ivy is another one, if they've just completely encroached on that area and you want to start over and you really don't have the level of lawn that's kind of, you know, it all depends on the homeowner and what their expectations are. For sometimes, in some cases, you know, having weeds in a green is acceptable. To other homeowners, they want a little more work and pride to go into it and have a better looking lawn.
All right. And so your goal is to have the grass growing so strongly and so thickly that it crowds out these other weeds.
Correct.
All right. And if you're not starting from scratch, I think that's pretty self-explanatory. What if you want to take care of some of those patchier areas?
The first thing you would do, and I recommend, is going in and aerifying and just, you know, do the whole lawn, because it will definitely help the areas that have turf, but it will also open up an area that is good for a seed bed in the existing lawn and what is there in these patchy areas. And that will help your germination when you apply seed. You'll kind of get it at a few different levels and depths, and you just get overall much better germination. And you notice in the aerification holes, those are the first areas that if you do from scratch and you aerify before, those areas that you aerify, you will see the grass come up a lot quicker, and okay. It'll be a lot more hardy grass and just overall better rooting and overall quality.
How often do you recommend doing the core aeration?
On home lawns, just once in the fall is usually suitable. Kentucky bluegrass is primary. That's, you know, why I keep on mentioning it. And, you know, it creates that thatch layer over time, which is just that dead organic matter. And just from the stems, the roots, and that builds up over time. And usually in Iowa, because, you know, it doesn't grow all year round, then just once is fine. If you start getting in the southern part of the state and possibly using, you know, some people have kind of moved to zoysia grass and different things like that, then maybe a secondary aerification might be needed.
When you go to buy seed for your lawn, no matter what the project is, how do you decide what kind of seed is right?
Well, it's all depends on the homeowner and what their expectations are. That's one of the biggest things, and what they want out of their lawn. Do they want a nice, flush, full lawn? And then it's an easy decision in Kentucky bluegrass, when usually there can be a little bit of perennial ryegrass in there, just because between 10 is usually a pretty good number, between 10 and 20, just because it comes up so quickly. And so it kind of holds the stabilization of the soil and just provides kind of that time that it takes, that 21 to 28 days before you even see the Kentucky bluegrass actually emerge from the seed. So it all depends on kind of the homeowner and what their needs are. You know, some other options, you know, the tall fescue. There's a lot of new tall fescue cultivars coming out, and it does very good in unirrigated situations. Most people know tall fescue as that one weed in the last two summers that is out there. Your grass is completely went dormant, and that big clump of turf, in most cases, it's tall fescue, and it's green. And now they're starting to, they've done a lot of work in shorter blade length, and it's just, it's a lot more hardy. It does a lot better during the drought of the summer. So that's another option for when kind of a low maintenance. You don't get the same characteristics. You don't get that fine leaf blade, the softness as you do Kentucky bluegrass.
Right. We've talked a lot in recent years about Kentucky bluegrass and in some ways being a grass that's more difficult to grow than many others. Why do you think Kentucky bluegrass is the most predominant grass that people still want on their lawns?
Just because of that fine texture, and because the last 20, 30 years we've recommended it, and they see the results when managed correctly, when under the right inputs, adding some fertilizer and a little bit in the spring and a little bit in the fall, aerifying, it could provide your best appearance of any of the grasses out there.
All right. So what is your window for opportunity for seeding your lawn? I mean, as Richard was saying, it's been a really good summer for this kind of thing, but of course, we can't exactly predict what will happen in the fall. What are the best chances for us? What window?
Pretty much right now and for the next month. So you get that August 15th to September 15th. You could go a little later, but try to get it in the next month.
All right. And you were talking about the thatch on your lawn that tends to collect. Do you need to go through and really rake that out, clear out old debris?
Nope. So aerifying will actually pull some of that out. That's one of the big reasons for actually coring lawns, is to remove that actual physical removal. And what it is, it builds up over time. So the microbials and activity and different microorganisms actually break it down in the soil. But if it's growing faster than they could break it down, that's when coring is needed.
All right. And there are lots of people who have alternate lawns. That seems to be getting to be more and more popular. Is this a good time of year to plant other kinds of seeds as well? For example, if you wanted to try to put in some native plants?
Definitely. Just, you know, it depends on the seasonality of it. It depends on the actual native plant that you're referring to. But the soil temperatures and just that rainfall, extra rainfall, and it's just perfect conditions.
All right. Well, we have a lot of people who are already sending us lawn questions and other questions, so we're going to jump right into questions here. And you are welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, ISU Extension Turfgrass Specialist Ryan Adams and ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron. And here's a question from Maddie, who posted on our Facebook page. I put rugs out on my lawn for a half an hour or so to try and dry them, and now the grass that was under them is all brown. Should I assume the grass is dead, dig it up and seed, or see if it comes back green in the spring?
How long was the mess on it?
She said a half an hour.
So a half an hour, and with the heat, it's possible it comes back. If it doesn't come back in the next week, then I would move to seeding this fall.
All right, so you think that maybe if it was just a very hot day that...
Exactly. Hot day and no moisture and just that added heat and no air movement and just all those different factors could have caused it to die. It could have just kind of pushed it into kind of a dormant stage, so it could come back. So I'd give it about a week of good conditions and see where you kind of end up.
All right. That seems so brief. That's not fair. All right. Here's a question from Tom in Johnston. Are there any effective and affordable organic fertilizers for lawns? And his second question is there less nutrient runoff with the use of organic fertilizers?
There's definitely less. Any kind of slow release that it's not all. Some of these soluble fertilizers like ammonium sulfate, 100% of what is applied, 100% of what you apply is immediately available for plant uptake. So with some of these organic and some other types of slow release fertilizer, it changes it. So it kind of just slowly releases it over a long period of time. And so with that slow release, there's less movement, not all 100%. Because obviously the 100% that you apply that is soluble, it could end up anywhere. And the plant's not going to use all 100% at one time. So that kind of slow, kind of gradual release of the nitrogen is definitely more beneficial for the environment and preventing runoff and leaching.
Okay, so the key there is slow release, not organic, but finding something that is not soluble immediately?
Correct.
And is that getting to be more common? Is that something that's easy to find?
Yeah. I mean, most of the products, even if you go to Earl May or any of the big box stores, you're going to see a lot more slow-release products on the shelves.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking lawn care right now with Iowa State University Extension Turfgrass Specialist Ryan Adams. ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron is also here. You can call with your lawn questions, your garden questions, your landscape questions, tree questions. We'll answer them all. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or post on our Facebook page. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. We've been talking lawn care so far, but you can join the conversation with your questions about any of the things that you grow, your lawn, your garden, your landscape, even houseplants. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can also post on our Facebook page. With me today, ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron and ISU Extension Turfgrass Specialist Ryan Adams. And our first call is from Chris in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
What's your question?
I cut the backyard sod out of a client's backyard, and then things just got kind of busy. But I thought about doing a fall planting. I know you mentioned when I just turned the show on that I've got about a 30-day window or so. I just wanted to know what kind of seed I should get, where I should get it. It's shady, and it's about half shady, and I guess that's about it.
I would. About a 60-40, so you're going to use a combination of Kentucky bluegrass and fine fescue. So the fine fescue does a lot better in the shade than Kentucky bluegrass. Is it kind of spotty? Uh-huh. So is it full shade, or is it get some sun in some areas?
It's shaded by a berry tree, about half.
About half of it. So, yeah, I would say I would go with that about that 60-40
range. Well, actually
about
a third of it, I guess.
Only a third. So, yeah, 60-30 kind of. And so you could kind of find mixtures. So it will actually – and you could go pretty much anywhere and ask about fine fescue. In most cases, the fine fescues will be with – in a mixture with Kentucky bluegrass. And I think that's your best bet. And so in the sun areas, the Kentucky bluegrass is going to thrive. And where the Kentucky bluegrass struggles, then you're going to have those fine fescues. And some of these areas that, you know, over the course of the next 2-3 years that struggle in the shade, you might want to go back and add some more fine fescue.
Okay, so is the fine fescue the 60 and the fescue the 40 and the Kentucky is the 60 or the other way around?
Correct. The 60% Kentucky bluegrass, 40% fine fescue.
Okay, great. Hey, thank you so much. Now, one quick question, should I check this, do a soil test like I did for my garden in my backyard and put anything on beforehand or not?
It wouldn't hurt to do a soil test and figure out what your phosphorus level is and kind of your ranges before, and then use those recommendations for a starter fertilizer.
All right, Chris, thanks a lot for your call. And let's go to a question from email. This is from Ryan. Hi, I have a large raspberry bush that is not producing much fruit this year. I pruned the shoots down to 6 to 8 inches tall last fall after it died off. The vegetative growth was huge this year, but almost no fruit. Is this a function of the year and weather or something else?
It was a function of the pruning, I think. Most of your raspberries, the canes live 2 years, and most of them bear the second year. And so if they pruned them back to within 6 to 8 inches, there was basically nothing there left to produce fruit.
Okay, so next year should be a very good year as long as he doesn't do that again.
Right. Now, if they're a black raspberry or a purple raspberry, what they should do is when those canes get about 3.5 feet tall, they should remove the upper 2 or 3 inches. Basically remove that top growth, and that way they won't get to be, let's say, 8-10 feet tall, but they'll form side branches, and those side branches will produce a lot of fruit the next year. So,
all right. Let's go back to the phones. Next up, we've got Casey on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Casey.
Good morning. I am surrounded by set aside that is inundated with Canada thistle, and so my vegetable garden and my flower beds have Canada thistle everywhere, and I'm having a really hard time getting rid of it. I've contacted the weed commissioner, and he is getting on the farmer's case about getting his problem fixed. In the last couple of years, it looked like it was snowing in my yard. How can I get rid of that? I'm just stuck with thistle everywhere.
Yeah, it's going to take persistence on your part. I think basically in some of your landscape beds, what I would use would be Roundup.
Go ahead and use Roundup.
And I would basically probably use a foam-type paintbrush, and where it's growing in with other plants, use that foam-type paintbrush and apply it very directly to the thistles. And do it persistently. As soon as you see some new plants coming up, do that. Thistles have deep root systems, and especially Canada thistle.
I tried pulling it for 5 or 6 years and realized that didn't work.
Pulling is not going to work, and so you have to be
painful.
it's painful, and you don't accomplish much. So basically, be persistent, and I'd probably use the Roundup.
How about in the yard? Is the over the counter Weed Be Gone, does that seem to affect?
Well, mowing
the lawn?
Mowing will help somewhat, and then in the fall of the year, you can definitely apply a broadleaf herbicide, and maybe apply it twice, maybe 2 or 3 weeks apart. So the combination of mowing, applying your broadleaf herbicide, at least you might be able to kind of contain it somewhat. You may not get rid of it, but at least you'll kind of contain it. So you just have to be persistent because it's a very, very persistent plant itself. So,
thank you. Yes, thank you very much.
All right, good luck, Casey. I've been thinking about the same problem. I think maybe goats or a small donkey might help me out, but they'll kill everything else out, everything else too. So, all right, Beverly is on the line next from Corydon. Hi, Beverly.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is about my African violets. They seem to lose bottom leaves more than I think they should, and I wonder if it's a matter of not watering correctly.
Well, it could be. The way that I would do it is to water well when you do it, meaning I want to see some water come out the bottom of the pot. The excess water should be discarded. And then before you water again, basically check it fairly frequently. Just use your finger. And when the soil surface becomes dry to the touch, then go ahead and water. So that's typically the way to do it.
Well, I do try to do that.
Okay.
But maybe I might do it a little too often, so I'll have to close down. Then I also have a comment. Last spring, early, I called and said I was growing a seedless tomato, and no one thought that would happen.
Right, right. But I told you to call back and tell us about it.
Well, it's all right.
Oh, good.
It did happen. It has tiny little flecks, you know, maybe like a big piece of ground pepper or something like that. And there's not much substance to them. They're not hard. They're just kind of a flake. And so they don't have any large seeds.
So they basically are kind of like a seedless watermelon where the seeds do not develop fully. They form a little bit, so they're very small, but they don't develop fully. So, yeah, that's...
Yeah, and it's no substance to it. You know, it's just like a thin little piece of plastic or paper.
How did the tomatoes taste?
I tried them both ways. All the tomatoes seem to be real firm this year. But if I let them start to get soft, they have a very good flavor.
All right. And, you know, I guess I feel like seedless watermelon doesn't taste as good as watermelon with seeds. So do you have an opinion? Do you think maybe not quite as good, or are they just as good?
Well, the ones I've had, I haven't had a lot so far, but I thought it was good when I let it get quite ripe.
All right.
And I've had them from like 4 ounces up to 7, and it said in the catalog from 4 to 8, so...
Sounds pretty accurate, yeah.
I would say this year hasn't been the best year for tomatoes as far as it's been on the cool side, a lot of rain, a lot of cloudy days. So it hasn't been the best weather for tomatoes. So if she thinks they taste good this year, then I would think in a better year they'd have a better taste.
All right. Beverly, thank you so much for the update. That's great. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. With me today, Ryan Adams and Richard Duran from ISU Extension. And here's a question from Tom in Urbandale. I recently moved to the Des Moines area. The house we bought may have trouble with trees. On the west side of the house, the prior owners planted a regular ash tree 11 feet from the house and a seedless ash 9 feet. I've been cutting limbs from the house side, but I'm afraid that these trees, though cute while little, can't be left as they are so close. They appear to be at least 15 years old and are taller than the house. What are your thoughts?
Well, they're too close to the house, yes. But they also have to contend with the emerald ash borer, too, at some point. So I think what I'd be inclined to do is, if there is additional space available, not occupied, I would plant some trees maybe further away from the house and maybe live with these trees for a few more years and then eventually take them out.
All right. So enjoy their shade for a couple more years.
Right. Because... Once the emerald ash borer does get here, you basically have two options. One is to treat every year or let them go. So at some point, I think taking them out is the right course of action.
Right. All right. And on the subject of ash trees, this is from Chris in Mason City. The ash tree on the south side of our home is dropping its leaves, not single leaves, but branch tips with 3 to 5 leaves. They have some gold spots on them. What's up?
I would guess maybe squirrels. Squirrels love to chew off small branches. They're typically maybe 6 inches in length, maybe a foot. And if you examine the end, you can see it's been chewed off. So I would suspect possibly squirrels.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. And Sonia is on the line from Independence. Hello.
Hi.
What's your question?
We have a lot of creeping Charlie in our grass. I'm wondering, do we need to start over, or Is there something else we can do?
Okay. A question for you. Is it more than 50% creeping Charlie?
In some spots it is.
Okay.
But overall, it might be 40%.
Okay. Well, I think if it's more grass and creeping Charlie, I would try to save the grass and kill the creeping Charlie. And I would wait a bit longer. And I would apply a broadleaf herbicide probably sometime late September, early October. And the product that you use should contain either 2,4-D or triclopyr. And I would come back in a month and do it again. And the funny thing is, the herbicide doesn't directly kill the creeping Charlie or ground ivy, but it does drastically affect it, and it actually winter kills. And so when you apply these materials, you go out in November, it looks perfectly healthy. It's not, and usually in the spring it's dead. So the key there is to do it twice, about a month apart, and the first time can be late September, early October.
And oh, right.
And even in some cases, even after the first frost. So that's the best time to hit it. And just be persistent with it, and you might have to do it again the second year, but after the second year, it might be gone.
All right, and this is something that people ask us about all the time in the spring when they see the creeping Charlie
mm-hmm.
come up.
Right.
But the fall's the only time to use this solution, right?
It works best. It tends to be that combination of the herbicide and the extreme cold in winter that kills it. So you don't get that in the spring, obviously, so... not as effective.
And one of the main reasons for that is because it's trying to prepare for winter. So it's trying to put all of its reserves through that entire root system, through that entire runners. And so with it moving all those reserves and trying to store, it will actually move and translocate that herbicide throughout the entire plant. And so that gives it better. And so it weakens the entire plant, not just right at where it's applied.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Sonia. And next up, Nancy in Adel. Hi, Nancy.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
My problem is my potted geraniums that I moved outside just never recovered from the moving outside. They look nice in the winter, big leaves and big blossoms. But out there, they, of course, lost their original blossoms they had in the house for the winter, and the new ones are supposed to come on. But the new ones came on, but they never got the normal size. The geraniums did bloom well, but it's strange, and I just wondered, I even applied fertilizer thinking that might help bring along the leaves, but it didn't.
Well, basically, when you have something indoors, oftentimes they get really tall and lanky, and if they are, I would cut them back around March or so, and then let them grow back, and then when you bring them outside, initially put them in the shade, complete shade for 2 or 3 days, and then gradually expose them to longer periods of sunlight. And I would also probably start to fertilize sometime around May, and I would just use a water-soluble product like Miracle-Gro. And I think if you do those things, you should have a very nice, healthy plant if you do those things. But they do get very, very tall when they're grown inside, and if you bring those out full size, they don't adapt very well at all. So I typically try to prune them back indoors if I can in March or April.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. And next, let's go to Terry, who's on the road. Hi, Terry.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
I've got a question about Colorado aspen trees. I have several in my yard in Minnesota. And I know they're vulnerable to that type of fungus, the leaves. I know it doesn't kill the tree. I know you have to get the leaves up in the fall. So, but what product will actually kill that fungus? I battle this every year.
Well, I'm not sure what type of leaf spot you're referring to. Now, in Iowa, quaking aspens have some problems. They're not very well adapted to our state as far as our weather conditions and soil conditions, so sometimes they do struggle quite a bit. The leaf spots typically are not the big problem. The cankers typically are the more serious problem. And with the cankers, you really can't control those with fungicides. Controlling a leaf spot is possible, but it is kind of hard to spray a big tree, and usually we don't recommend it.
Okay.
Raking the leaves typically would be helpful, and yep. usually it's not necessary to spray the actual tree. But to me, the far greater concern would be the canker, because that's a fungus that attacks the branches or the trunk, and it can definitely kill the tree.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
All right, Terry, thanks a lot for your call. And here's a quick one before we get to the break from Laura in Fort Dodge. Can you tell me the best time to transplant perennial flowers?
Well, there's no one answer to that. It depends upon the plant.
All right, so she wants to transplant some daisy-like plants that have spread all over her flower beds.
Okay.
And she wants to transplant hostas.
There's kind of a rule of thumb. If the plant blooms basically in late summer, early fall, like garden mums and sedum, things like that, we're going to transplant them in the spring of the year. If they bloom in the spring of the year, things like, for example, peonies, we're going to transplant those in the fall of the year.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment to answer more of your questions. With me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Iowa State University Extension turfgrass specialist Ryan Adams. The number to call, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension turfgrass specialist Ryan Adams. They are here to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or post on our Facebook page. And Ryan, here's a question for you from Walter. And we talked about this a little bit earlier, but he says, we have a serious problem with rust in our lawn this summer. Dogs' feet are red. Our shoes are red. I understand this may be a question of general lawn health and soil fertility. The yard is significantly but not totally shaded. Drainage is excellent. We're on a hill. Lawn is established. The house was built about 1978. In years past, I've fertilized in the spring with fertilizer and crabgrass preventer. Missed it this year, and it shows. Any suggestions for both treating this season and better managing the lawn next season?
One of the biggest things, and when rust is a lot of problem, usually a sign of that is low fertility. So I think missing that crabgrass preventer and the fertilizer in the spring is definitely one of the causes of why you have rust. So I would definitely get a maintenance schedule and definitely try to hit that in the spring with a little bit of fertilizer. So applying some fertilizer this fall will definitely help out, and then in future years try to hit that spring one as well. And also, if the lawn is irrigated, try to do it in the early morning hours, and not the longer that those leaves are wet, the better a chance that you're going to see rust. So try to avoid early kind of evening watering, so it's wet all night long.
All right. And this is from Andre in Des Moines, who's having a number of problems with different creatures in his neighborhood. So we'll skip to his biggest problem. And I realize that neither one of you is a wildlife specialist, but I know this is one you've had a lot, Richard. He says, my biggest problem is with moles or gophers. I don't know which I have. I tried getting rid of the grubs in the ground, which was what I've been told was what they were after, but they're still here. Fortunately, they've not killed any of my plants, but I'm going out every evening and stepping on their tunnels so the plants don't dry out. They're turning my lawn brown wherever the tunnels are present, despite my collapsing their tunnels, and I'm concerned. So the question is, how do I effectively get rid of them without spending too much money and without having to hire someone that specializes in pest control?
Well, when you said tunnels and they tamp them down, that says mole, not gopher, so we know what it is. As far as control, there's no easy answer with those. Trapping is the best way, but you have to be persistent. It's not going to be a one-week job. It may be a month job, maybe 2 months. And you simply keep on moving the trap around, and eventually you'll catch it if you're persistent. They do feed on grubs in the soil, but that's just a small part of their diet. The main part of their diet is earthworms. So even if you kill every single grub in the ground, you're not going to get rid of the moles, because there's still plenty of earthworms. So People try various things, but the most effective control would be the trapping. It just is very difficult to do. You have to be persistent.
All right. Well, if he's stomping on tunnels every day, he may be willing to be persistent. All right. This is Mary on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Mary.
Hi. A couple of years ago, I have these trees in my yard, and I call them a silver poplar. I'm not sure if that's the correct name, but they're not the skinny Lombardy poplar. They're, they grow from the root tips up, you know, and the bark looks rather birch-like, really. But anyway, I read in the paper that they are one of a handful of trees that do not cleanse the air of carbon dioxide. And I wondered, I thought that was awfully strange. Have you ever heard of that before, Richard?
No, no. I don't believe that's true.
Good. So. I'm wondering, why do I have them? Because
now,
they're a real nuisance. I'm going to have solid trees if I don't.
Right. The white,
I just let it go.
The white poplar is fairly easy to identify in that the upper leaf surface is a dark, dark green. But the lower leaf surface is a white. It's kind of fuzzy.
Yeah.
And so
that
you have that,
like
that fuzzy white underside of the leaf, very easy to identify. The other thing which it does, which is very aggravating, to us at least, it produces suckers or sprouts from the roots.
Right.
And they pop up all over the place. And if you don't do anything, what they quickly do is they form a thicket. And that's what they do in nature. But in the yard, it's not something that you typically want at all, so you have to cut them off.
Right. I go around cutting them off all the time. Do you know a better way to keep them back? I don't want to kill the parent trees, really.
Right, right. That is your only option. You would simply have to go out there, and I guess I would be inclined to prune them off with a pruning shears right back to the ground, just because if you use a lawnmower, you're still going to have that cut stub, which can be kind of dangerous as far as people walking on it. So I would just typically go out there periodically with the pruning shears and cut them right off at the ground.
And that's a white poplar is the correct
I think white poplar, right.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, Mary, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, we've got Sue in Central City. Hi, Sue.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, my first question is... we had the large shade tree that was damaged and we had to take out because of the storms. And I'm wanting to replace it with a fast-growing shade tree. And I've looked at tulip trees, and I just want to know if you have any other ideas or if you have any information on tulip trees.
Right. Well, the truly fastest trees, as far as growth rate, are not really good shade trees because they tend to be weak-wooded. So something like a silver maple really isn't a good shade tree. What I would probably look at would be, for example, maybe some of these silver maple, red maple hybrids. They're very common, like Autumn Blaze. It's a very common cultivar. There are other cultivars too. So I would look at some of these hybrid maples. I would also look at a honey locust. I would look at a red oak. Now, red oaks have this reputation for growing very slowly, but not the red oak. It does pretty well as far as growth rate. So those would be some of the things that I would consider. I want something that is pretty durable. I don't want something that's going to break apart in a storm. So.
And the tulip tree would not be as durable.
Well, the tulip tree is okay, but the tulip tree maybe isn't quite as adaptable. And by that I mean... it likes kind of a moist environment and in a very open, very windy, exposed site, maybe it doesn't do so well.
Okay.
And some of the other trees would.
Okay, very good. And I have one other question. We used to have Japanese beetles, really a lot of them, and this year we haven't had as many. And is that because of the cooler summer?
Well, actually, it's because of two things. Late last summer, August and September, it was very dry. And those very dry soil conditions probably resulted in the death of some of the young larvae. Okay, that's one thing. But then the big thing was the extreme cold this winter, where we had very, very cold soil temperatures. And there are some people, like in Illinois, for example, that estimate maybe two-thirds of the larvae were killed by the cold temperatures. So when you combine the dry conditions last summer and then the winter conditions, very few survived, which is good, I think.
Right, right. And so it finally answers that question that everybody was speculating on last winter, although everybody really wanted the emerald ash borer to be killed, and obviously that didn't happen.
That didn't work,
so,
no.
Nope. All right. Liz is on the line next in Coralville. Hi, Liz.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, here's my question. Oh. Hang on.
Yep.
There we go. I have Asiatic lilies that are done blooming, and I heard somewhere or read somewhere online, and of course I can't find it now, that you wait to pick up the dead stalks until a certain point, either they're all yellow or whatever, because to cut them off too quick will cause a problem next year? That's one question, and I've got another one.
Well, in general with perennials, I leave the foliage till the foliage has been destroyed by a hard freeze, okay? Because as long as the foliage is green, it's still functioning, it's manufacturing food, and then storing some of that food down into the roots or bulb in the case of lilies. And so as long as the foliage is healthy, I would leave it. But once you have a hard killing freeze and things start to dry or die up, at that point you can cut them off. So typically sometime late October, November is the time to cut them back.
All right. And Liz, very quickly, your next question.
Yeah, next question. I've got cherry tomatoes that are producing in abundance, very sweet, orange kind, and they're wonderful. Some of them, I got some kind of blight on them, and I treated them with an organic thing. Some of the tomatoes have little black spots on them, like maybe one spot, and some of them don't. Is that related to that blight? And, I mean, like what I'm doing is separating them out, and I'm eating the ones that...
Right. Well, it definitely could be disease-related. We had very wet conditions in May and June, and many of your plant pathogens basically require a wet surface. And so with all that rain in May and June, we're seeing a lot of various diseases on tomatoes this year.
All right, Liz, thank you so much for your call. Noelle is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Noelle.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call, and I hope you have an answer for me. I have a 100-year-old-plus-old red oak tree in my yard that all of a sudden mid-June or mid-July started dropping green leaves, like on the south side of the tree, way up at the top. Now the on the south side of the tree, the crown, it started to brown at the crown, and now it's spread on down. I did have cicadas terrible this year. I've had two arborists from two different tree companies come out and look at it. They don't think it's oak wilt because there hasn't been any oak trees close to me that has died that are of the red oak variety. But I'm at my house right now and I'm watching more leaves fall, and I'm just going to be heartbroken if my tree can't be saved. Do you have any ideas?
Well, the two things that I worry about most with oak trees would be oak wilt, because that is a fatal disease for red oaks, and usually they die within a few months. So they go from nice and healthy to totally dead within a few months. Once they get it, you really can't stop it, and so they will die. The other thing I worry about them would be, especially larger ones, is any type of activity around the root system, like construction, that would damage the roots. Because if you get major root damage, that can also kill the tree. Beyond that, I don't worry about them too much. So it's either typically oak wilt or possibly construction activity. What you might want to do is, we have a publication on oak wilt. You might want to go to Google and maybe type that in, Oak Wilt, Iowa State University, and read that publication. But that would be my biggest concern, would be either oak wilt or construction activity.
All right. Noel, thank you so much for your call. We have so many questions, and we're starting to run out of time here. Here's one from Barbara in Percival. I have a hydrangea that I planted last spring. It's now about 6 inches tall. What happened? It didn't grow at all. When can it be transplanted?
Well, that may be a function of the fact that we had a very cold winter, and there are a number of different hydrangeas. The big leaf hydrangeas, they tend to be the most finicky, and sometimes they can die back quite severely. The other ones are typically much more hardy. So I would be inclined to leave it there and see what it does maybe next year, give it one more year. And if you decide to transplant it, then I would basically do that in early spring before it starts to leaf out.
All right. And she also wants to know when she can transplant spirea bushes.
Spirea, I would probably do that in early spring again before they start to leaf out.
All right. And here's Mary in Morning Sun. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
A quick question. I have a bank of rutabaga that are self-seeding for probably 10 years now. And all of a sudden this year, it's a 20-foot long bed. Beautiful. Many of the blooms, sometimes on the same plant as a regular bloom, are green. When they open, they're green.
Right.
The center's obviously brown, but the petals are green. Sometimes, I'd say more than half are that way.
Okay.
I want to know whether I pull them all and give, you know, and use seeds from last year that I still have and start over, or what's the aberration? What's happened?
I wonder if that might be due to maybe aster yellows, which is a very odd little disease that we sometimes see. And it basically will cause the flowers to be distorted in shape and color and size. What you might want to do on that is take some digital photographs of these flowers and the plants, some nice clear photographs, and send those to our plant disease clinic. And their email address is P as in plant, I as in insect, D as in disease, C as in clinic, at iastate.edu. And see if they think that's what it might be. That would be maybe my guess. Maybe aster yellows, which is a disease caused by a very unique organism.
All right. Mary, thanks a lot for your call. Sorry, that's not great news. Final question, very quickly from Pauline. I've had a problem with blight. I moved the tomatoes using the same cages. Do I need to do anything to the cages to prevent spread next year?
Just make sure there's no dead debris clinging to the actual cage itself. So make sure they're clean.
All right. Richard Giron, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. Ryan Adams, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Iowa State University Extension turfgrass specialist Ryan Adams will be back again with Horticulture Day next Friday. This is Talk of Iowa, and River to River is coming up today at noon. Ben Kiefer is here in the studio with me. What do you have on the show today, Ben?
Hi, Charity. A little quiz for you. Who said this famous quote, "Corporations are people, my friend"?
Mitt Romney.
There you go. From 2011 at the Iowa State Fair, our first half hour will be spent with Kathy Obradovich of the Des Moines Register and Joyce Russell, our own Joyce Russell, talking about what's going on at the political soapbox this year at the fair. Also, Kyle Munson with his observations. Some other things, too. Rick Fredrickson will be along to tell us about his day with Robin Williams on the set of Good Morning Vietnam. That was back in 1987 when they filmed that. We'll hear about that at the end of the hour.
He's got great pictures, too.
Yes, he does.
That's awesome. Well, news buzz today at noon. Thanks a lot, Ben. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.